Hello, and welcome again to another Conservative Historian Podcast. This one entitled, The Soviet Union and Today, Russian and Ukrainian History, Part 4, March 2022. And now a few thoughts from Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Bolsheviks and founder of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics, also known as the Soviet Union. Quote, "Give me a child for the first 5 years of his life, and he will be mine forever." Here's another gem. The way to crush the bourgeoisie is to grind them between the millstones of taxation and inflation. I'm beginning to think one of our parties has figured this one out. Yeah, well aligned with Vladimir Lenin. Here's another one. One man with a gun can control 100 without one. Once again, I mean, there's so many. It's Lenin, people. There are no morals in politics. There is only expedience. A scoundrel may be of use to us just because he is a scoundrel. The press should not only be a collective propagandist and a collective agitator, but also a collective organizer of the masses. It's too bad Jeff Zucker is no longer at CNN. He probably could have related to that one. Capitalists are no more capable of self-sacrifice than a man is capable of lifting himself up by his own bootstraps. And here's the final one. The goal of socialism is communism. As frequent listeners of this podcast know, I often like to begin with quotes to illuminate the figure with whom I'm presenting or the historical point I'm trying to make. But these quotes seem to be particularly haunting. If one were to take out the name of Lenin and, let's say, insert an array of prominent Democratic politicians, including Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, Sheldon Whitehouse, or at times even President Joe Biden, the quotes would not be determined to be inaccurate. Take just this first one, where Lenin wants to control the mind and spirit of a child. Two goals of the current democratic establishment are to remove parents from the determination of curricula in public schools while simultaneously creating a public pre-K option. The money aspect is evident in that creating more grades means more teachers. Thus, more union dues go to democratic politicians. But the second culture part is even more insidious. In his failed bid for Virginia's governorship, Terry McAuliffe gave the game away when he stated, quote, "I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach," unquote. Why else would the hue and cry over the Florida education law be so intense? The law is pretty straightforward in banning the teaching of sex and gender to seven-year-olds. And the law also states that if a child should inquire about these things, the teacher must inform the parents. Oh my God, because it has to be in a law? Because the teacher wouldn't inform the parent of this inquiry? It's crazy. The parents raise the children. In this case, they want the teachers to do it. The left, including this president, makes it sound like the law is a gay ban, so they have to twist the meaning to justify their indoctrinations, and in this, they are wholly akin to Vladimir Lenin. The late great movie critic Roger Ebert wrote many times that a movie is not about something, but how it is about something. Action, adventure, superheroes, rom-coms, dramas, and documentaries cover essentially the same ground, but instead, it is how the rom-com or action is portrayed and acted. Personally, if I have to see one more chasing to a European street where the protagonist or villain does not get stuck in traffic, I will lose it. But this is why, in many books about authoritarian or totalitarian dictatorships, George Orwell stands out. It is how his book is about government. America of 2022 is one that elected a black president twice and boasts a current black vice president. And now, in the next couple of days from this recording, 22% of the Supreme Court will be black, against that of a 12% representation of blacks in the population as a whole. Yet the Democrats, including President Biden, claim that we are in a Jim Crow 2.0. Really? A Jim Crow 2.0? It is hard not to think of Orwell's Ministry of Truth. The ministry, of course, was the propaganda arm of the regime ruling Oceania, thus the apparent twist. That was from his masterpiece, 1984. But another of his famous books, Animal Farm, is a parallel fiction tale of Russia in 1917. In that book, an authoritarian farmer harshly rules over the animals. Ruling this regime, the animals rise, but one of them, Napoleon, the pig, proves to be even worse than the dictatorial farmer he replaced. The difference is that whereas the farmer was, well, what he was, Napoleon couches him in the style of beneficence. According to Orwell, the fable reflects events leading up to the Russian Revolution of 1917 and then on into the Stalinist era of Soviet Union. Think about it this way. The farmer ruling over the animals was Nicholas II, the Tsar of all Russias, but Napoleon the pig, a far worse dictator, is Vladimir Lenin or Joseph Stalin. Now, Orwell, a democratic socialist, was a critic of Joseph Stalin and hostile to Moscow-directed Stalinism, an attitude that was critically shaped by his experiences during the May Days conflicts between the POM and Stalinist forces during the Spanish Civil War. In a letter to Ivan DeVoe, Orwell described Animal Farm as a satirical tale against Stalin, and in his essay, Why I Write, he wrote that Animal Farm was the first book in which he tried, with full consciousness of what he was doing, to, quote, fuse political purpose and artistic purpose into one whole. I have said before that the Soviet regime was worse than the Nazis. This is certainly true in terms of total mass murder. But aside from the odd invasion of Finland and dicing up Poland with Hitler, the Soviets tried to stay within their borders. This does not mean that the 80-year history of the Soviet Union did not see the regime suborning other regimes or engaging in proxy fights, sometimes with the United States and places like, oh, Vietnam, but rather it was the somewhat subtle nature of their conquests. The likes of Neville Chamberlain may have appeased Hitler, but this was in the service of avoiding another World War I. Now, I am by no means letting Chamberlain off the hook, but history needs context. And in this case, after the greatest slaughter of humanity the world had ever witnessed just 20 years in the past, the desire for peace was at least understandable. However, this was not history, but something they had lived through for Chamberlain and his ilk. My point is, there was an understanding of Hitler and, of course, after 1939, a confrontation. They knew Hitler was a thoroughly bad man. They just were not had the stomach for war, well, except for Winston Churchill. But there are a parade of individuals, including Americans, who genuinely thought the Soviet Union was not only a place with which to do business, but a model for the United States. And that is one of the key differences. We left our last podcast with the brutal murder of Nicholas II and his entire family, including several teenagers. But we will briefly touch on the Russian Revolution of 1917, or both of them. The first occurred in March with the overthrow of the Tsarist government, and the second of which placed the Bolsheviks in power in October. So why did the initial provisional government eventually fall to the Bolsheviks? It is a complicated story, but a direct cause was that, due to pressure from the Allies, including Britain and France, and more conservative elements of the new government, led by Alexander Kerensky, the provisional government decided that Russia would remain in World War I, and not just in the war, but launch a broad offensive in the summer of 1917, a move that would prove to be disastrous. The Russian army, commanded by General Alexei A. Brusilov, attacked the Austro-German forces along a broad front in Galicia and pushed towards the city of Lviv, a city now in Ukraine and in the news. At first, the offensive proved remarkably successful. The Austrians were driven back, and many prisoners and guns were taken. In just 2 weeks, however, any gains had been erased. A German counterattack shattered the Russian lines, and the army fled in disarray. As Lenin said, the Russian soldiers had voted for peace with their legs. Not only was the Russian army destroyed, but Russia had effectively ceased to exist as a great power. While the army was disintegrating, the Bolsheviks were making their first bid for power in the capital. Ever since his arrival from exile, which occurred in Zurich, Lenin had been biding his time and maturing his plans. 6 months from the beginning of the revolution, the new republic was rapidly disintegrating. Eventually, whatever support the provisional government under Kerensky had enjoyed, whether from the army, the navy, or the peasants, shifted to the Bolsheviks. And by October 1917, support from most of the important constituencies had come to an end. With the help of crucial subordinates such as Leon Trotsky and Joseph Stalin, Lenin became the leader of Russia. Now, soon thereafter, a civil war broke out, and the Russian Civil War was to tear Russia apart for 3 years, between 1918 and 1921. The Civil War occurred because, after November 1917, many groups had formed that opposed Lenin's Bolsheviks. These groups included old monarchists, supporters of the Tsar, militarists who wanted to get back in the war, and foreign nations who were there for just a short time. Collectively, they were known as the Whites, while the Bolsheviks were known as the Reds. Unlike the Reds, who were led by the charismatic and often brilliant Leon Trotsky, the Whites were made up of many factions that in some regards hated each other as much as they hated the Reds. Though on a map of Russia, it looked as if the Reds were being attacked from all sides. Such attacks were disunited and dislocated. And the fact that so many groups existed meant that no one person could be appointed as their sole commander, unlike the Reds with Trotsky. With no unified leadership, the Whites were much weakened. It should be noted that the Whites were directly supported by foreign auxiliaries, including the British, and for a time, a small American contingent actually fought in the Russian Civil War. But with the end of World War I, enthusiastic support of the Whites from the Allies subsided, and they were eventually defeated. The Treaty of Riga was signed with Poland on March 18, 1921, and as a result of this treaty, about 10 million Ukrainians and White Russians were put under Polish rule. The Treaty of Riga ended the Russian Civil War, and within Russia, the communist government under Lenin was now secure. And here we come to the first of the American useful idiots. Those who believed in the power of the Soviet Union via a superior power than their native United States. Now, Lenin actually never used that term. The quote is sometimes attributed to him. He never actually said it, but you know he really believed it. Journalist and communist John Reed supported the Soviet takeover of Russia, even briefly taking up arms to join the Red Guards in 1918. And he actually hoped for a similar communist revolution in the United States and co-founded the short-lived Communist Labor Party of America in 1919. However, he died in Moscow of spotted typhus in 1920, and at the time of his death, he may have soured on the Soviet leadership. But he was given a hero's burial by the Soviet Union and is one of only three Americans buried at the Kremlin Wall necropolis. In his 2007 book entitled The Cossacks, historian Shane O'Rourke describes the fate of these peoples in the Russian Civil War. A little-known bid by an official Soviet government to exterminate the Don Cossacks is highlighted. The original secret document giving the order to eliminate the Cossacks altogether was found amongst Moscow archives, which have been opened up only in the last few years. It has subsequently been publicized more. The Soviet government had always denied issuing the order. The discovery of this order had helped illuminate what really happened. Quote, 10,000 Cossacks were slaughtered systematically in a few weeks in January 1919. And while that wasn't a huge number in terms of what happened throughout Russia, it was one of the main factors that led to the Cossacks' disappearance as a nation. With the end of Imperial Russia, the Cossacks, who were spread across southeastern Russia, had begun to see themselves as a separate nation-state. But the Civil War of 1918 through 1921 was a vital part of this transition to a sense of national identity. The experience of Bolshevik rule, which they rose against, convinced any doubters. The Soviet government's genocide order did not crush the Cossacks, but prompted a desperate rising, which threw the Bolsheviks out of the Don after a few weeks. But it ushered in the key stage of the Civil War, which finally the Cossacks lost, and later ravaged by disease and collectivization. which broke up their farms and communities, they lost all sense of cohesiveness. There are very few people now who can claim to be Cossacks, although there were a million before the Civil War destroyed their way of life and their lives. Unquote. The slaughter of the Cossacks was conducted under Lenin, but in his successor, Joseph Stalin, the Bolsheviks were just getting started. Following the death of Vladimir Lenin in 1924, a power vacuum opened in the Communist Party. Various established figures in Lenin's government, particularly Trotsky, who was instrumental in the rise and success of the Bolsheviks in the Russian Civil War, attempted to succeed Lenin. However, Joseph Stalin, the party's general secretary, would outmaneuver them all and ultimately gain control of the Communist Party by 1928. Initially, Stalin's leadership was widely accepted, and the doctrine of socialism in one country became enshrined in party policy. But one of his many blunders of Stalin was to change the agricultural focus of the Soviet Union, a cataclysmic mistake that would be repeated 50 years later by Mao in China, both to horrific effect. The Soviet famine of 1930 to 1933 was a famine in the major grain-producing areas of the Soviet Union, including the Ukraine, Northern Caucasus, Volga region, Kazakhstan, the South Urals, and West Siberia. About 6 to 9 million people are estimated to have lost their lives. Joseph Stalin and other party members had ordered that kulaks were to be liquidated as a class, and became a target for the state. These were rich landowners who were labeled as such. That's where the term kulaks comes from. These were the successful peasants who were to be targeted and destroyed. In other words, let's kill all of the smart people. The Bolsheviks portrayed them as class enemies, culminating in a Soviet campaign of political repression, including arrests, deportations, and executions of large numbers of the better-off peasants and their families in that period. Major contributing factors to the famine, including forced collectivization in the Soviet Union of agriculture as part of a first five-year plan that moved grain procurement, rapid industrialization, and a decreasing agricultural workforce and created severe droughts. As a result, some scholars have classified the famine in Ukraine and Kazakhstan as genocides committed by Stalin's government. They targeted ethnic Ukrainians and Kazakhs. In contrast, others dispute the relevance of any ethnic motivation, as is frequently implied by that term, and focused on the class dynamics between the landowning peasants, those kulaks, with a strong political interest in private property, and the ruling Soviet Communist Party's fundamental tenets, which were diametrically opposed to those interests. Whether you call that genocide and relate it to ethnicity, or whether you call it classism and relate it to the Communist Party, either way, millions died where they did not need to, because of Stalin's collectivization program. It is not a coincidence that the great famines of the 20th century both occurred in communist nations, nor that simultaneously the United States, with a population of hundreds of millions, would become a net exporter of food. As the brilliant writer Kevin Williamson of the National Review points out, when predominantly agricultural nations such as China or Russia convert to an industrialist society, it can appear as if this forced, swift transformation is a true sign of progress. After all, the United States took 70 years, roughly from the 1850s to the 1920s, and spurred on by the Civil War and World War I to make the transition from agriculture to industry. Stalin tried to do it in 5, and here we come to another of our valuable idiots. This was uttered by neither Lenin nor Stalin, but rather by the great economist Ludwig von Mises to describe those used by Lenin as propaganda. But the sentiment is resident in this Lenin quote. When a liberal is abused, he says, "Thank God they didn't beat me." When he is beaten, he thanks God they didn't kill him. And he will thank God that his immortal soul has been delivered from its mortal clay. Unquote. One of these folks was Rexford Tugwell, a later architect, and then even later rejecter, of the New Deal. This would be FDR's program. Although Tugwell never endorsed communism itself, there were multiple facets of the Soviet system that he admired. He appreciated the active role of the government regarding agriculture. Although Soviet farmers were still victims of the unbalance in the farmer-industry relationship, the government concerned itself with these matters and attempted to do something about them. Because, by God, whenever the government decides to do something about it, it's always going to end well. However, the most impressive thing to Tugwell were the Soviet villages. They were more cooperatively oriented than any New England town he had ever been to. The cooperation that Tugwell saw seemed to be naturally occurring. Quote, "Russia has accepted socialism in the form of communism," unquote. He wrote and later said, "The result is at least worthy of serious consideration." Overall, Tugwell argued that the Soviet system did not appear weak on the organizational side. Activities are coordinated in the public interest, and profit motivation is changed into the betterment of social welfare. Where have we heard that before? Since 1930, there has been little unemployment, and the most accumulated wealth has been directed towards social warfare. Furthermore, men are not greatly influenced by speculations as to which economic system does more, as long as they believe they are better off with their system. However, if the Russian levels of living begin to approach our own, the challenge will be a serious one. That's what Tugwell believed. That is because when he was in the Soviet Union and he was part of this journey of sort of discovery in the Soviet Union, that Stalin completely and utterly staged managed. The millions dying in the Ukraine and Kazakhstan, Tugwell did not see. The forced deportations of the kulaks, Tugwell never knew about them. And how Stalin was actually getting those people to look like they were going along, Tugwell never realized. And again, Tugwell and many who were with him on that trip went on to influence FDR and the New Deal. And in fact, of course, now we have the Green New Deal, which aspires to do something that Stalin would not have found eerily dissimilar. A lot of those famines and those droughts were not caused because Stalin merely sent in the troops and started murdering people, though he did that later on. No, a lot of it was just because he tried to force collectivization, because he took away the profit motive. He took away individual property rights. He took away the ability for somebody who works harder to keep what they earn. And millions died because of that. Robert Neymark, the Robert and Florence McDonald Professor of Eastern European Studies and a respected authority on the Soviet regime, stated of Stalin's power, "It's a horrific case of genocide, the purposeful elimination of all or part of a social group, a political group. Stalin had nearly a million of his own citizens executed beginning in the 1930s. Millions more fell victim to forced labor, deportation, famine, massacres, and detention and interrogation by Stalin's henchmen. In some cases, a quota was established for the number to be executed, the number to be arrested," said Neymark. "Some officials overfulfilled as a way of showing their exuberance," unquote. The Soviet Union introduced the collectivization of its agricultural sector between 1928 and 1940 during the ascension of Joseph Stalin. And it began during and was part of the first five-year plan. And again, the policy to integrate individual landholdings and labor into collectively controlled and state-controlled farms. The Soviet leadership confidently expected that replacing individual peasant farms with collective ones would immediately increase the food supply for the urban population, the collection of raw materials for the processing industry, and agricultural exports via state-imposed quotas on individuals working on collective farms. Planners regard collectivization as the solution to the crisis of agrarian distribution that had developed from 1927 on. Many historians agree that the disruption caused by collectivization and the peasants' resistance significantly contributed to the Great Famine, especially in the Ukraine. As noted, millions died, Roughly, the number is believed, between 6 to 9 million. But the New York Times noted a major Russian newspaper featuring a number as high as 20 million. The number exceeds even that of the 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. But it's not the highest number of mass murder in history. No, that record belongs to Mao's great leap forward in the 1950s, who tried to do something similar to what Stalin did. And of course, in both cases, the ruler imposed those mass murders on their subjects, so it gets slightly shorter shrift in history than what the Nazis did. However, the reality that two attempts at a communist solution to agriculture resulted in the most significant death tolls in history should give every would-be communist or Marxist pause before embracing this hideous ideology, in the same way that people logically and naturally abhor Nazism and fascism. It is one of those things that I will never understand how you would have within the United States today that nobody in, let's say, a campus, nobody who is leader of a movement like Black Lives Matter would publicly embrace Nazism or fascism. And yet, Patricia Cullors, the head of Black Lives Matter, said, "I am a trained Marxist." And you have people claiming communist and Marxist bona fides all over the academy, and now more and more in institutions and associations. By the early 1930s, party officials began losing faith in Stalin's leadership. Obviously, maybe all of those millions of deaths started to make some of those people around Stalin wonder. But Stalin always seemed to have an answer. They were losing faith in Stalin's leadership and the limited success of the first five-year plan. These policy failures led to Stalin's rivals, such as Leon Trotsky, attempting to sway the party away from Stalin's command. Not a good decision. By 1936, Stalin's paranoia reached a crescendo. The fear of losing his position, the potential return of Trotsky, who was now in exile, and the rising threat of fascism from the West goaded him into authorizing the Great Purge. The purges themselves were primarily conducted by the People's Communists for Internal Affairs, the secret police of the USSR. However, the initial stages of the purges were targeted at the Soviet government itself. Scholars estimate the death toll for the Great Purge that went from roughly 1936 to 1938 to be roughly 700,000. And keep in mind again, these were people within the border of the Soviet Union, and many of them were the original ardent supporters of Stalin himself. If there was one success of the Soviet Union, it was within the conflict with Germany in World War II. If the United States almost single-handedly won the war in the Pacific against Japan, it was the Soviet Union that indeed won the fight against the Germans on the Eastern Front. As a junior historian in middle school and high school, I read about the battles of El Alamein in Egypt, Patton in Sicily, and Eisenhower on D-Day, and of course, the Battle of the Bulge. The German army at El Alamein had 96,000 troops to put into this contest. The Wehrmacht had between 2 to 3 million on the Eastern Front. Without the Eastern Front, North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and Normandy probably would not have been possible. One of the more famous battles took place in 1942 at a city called Stalingrad, now Volgograd, in which a German army of 250,000 was surrounded and forced to surrender. But for me, the Battle of Kursk in 1943 was the turning point, because after this battle, the ability of Germany to stage offensives anywhere was decimated. If Stalingrad represented the first significant victory for the Soviets, Kursk mortally wounded the German army. Germany's extensive losses of men and tanks ensured that the victorious Soviet Red Army enjoyed the strategic initiative for the remainder of the war. The Battle of Kursk was the first time in the Second World War that a German strategic offensive was halted before it could break through enemy defenses and penetrate to its strategic depths. Though the Red Army had succeeded in winter offenses previously, their counteroffensives after the German attack at Kursk were their first successful summer offensives of the war. During Operation Citadel, the German name for the offensive, 54,182 casualties were suffered, 9,036 were killed, and 1,960 reported missing and 43,000 wounded. The German 9th Army suffered almost 25,000 casualties, while the Army Group South suffered closer to 30. During Operation Citadel, 250 to 320 tanks and assault guns were destroyed. By July 5th, when the Battle of Kursk started, there were roughly 185 operational Panthers, the Panthers being the most imposing tank weapon of the German army. Within 2 days, this had dropped to 40. Though the Soviets also sustained heavy losses, their ability to replace those losses, combined with Allied victories in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy, meant the Germans could not replace theirs. We noted in the previous podcast that it's probably a bad idea to start a land war in European Russia. Yet Hitler, flush from victories in Poland, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, believed he could succeed where Sweden's Charles XII and Napoleon Bonaparte had failed. He also knew that the Germans had fared extremely well against the Russians in World War I, and in 1941, there was no Western Front, no France to concern him. Finally, Hitler wanted land for his master race of Germans, and thinking of Slavic peoples as inferior, settled on invading the Soviet Union. Yet Hitler, like his invading European forebears, missed a few things. First, Germans in World War I were not trying to go all the way to Moscow. Instead, it was enough to just destroy Russian armies and hold the front. And Hitler had not planned on a prolonged campaign, so the winter of 1941 was especially brutal to his troops, who did not have the material or the equipment or the shelter to withstand the brutality of the Russian winter. Nor was the logistics in place to support 3 million troops hundreds of miles beyond their supply depots. Finally, Hitler was a terrible strategist, ordering his troops into untenable positions. The Stalingrad debacle might have been averted had Hitler allowed the army to retreat before getting surrounded. Finally, and grudgingly, credit must be attributed to Stalin himself, whose iron grip had kept the Red Army in place despite horrific losses in the summer or fall of 1941. And yet, though the Soviet efforts ensured victory against Hitler, the lead-up to Germany's invasion of Russia was slow, 2 years' walk into disaster. Rather than oppose, or at least prepare for the invasion, Stalin used the opportunity to join the Nazis in the carve-up of Poland and use the West's distractions to invade and conquer Finland. And in the spring of 1941, Hitler conquered Yugoslavia and Greece. Why these mountainous areas if not to protect the rear of his army from a Soviet assault? The Russian people, the Red Army, and Stalin himself showed great fortitude and determination. But it need not have been as terrible as some foresight. Aside from Stalin's willful ignorance of Hitler's intention, the type of army leaders who might have minimized Germany's earlier successes were dead, victim of Stalin's great purge. Now, two terms emerge from the post-World War II era. The first is Iron Curtain, and the second is the Cold War. The Iron Curtain was a reference to Red Army forces that established the Soviet Union-friendly governments. It was as if this entire region was segmented off from the rest of Europe, even the world, into a time of seclusion and mystery behind the curtain of iron. These nations included East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, and to a lesser extent Yugoslavia. The second term is the Cold War, or the state of political hostility between the Soviet bloc countries and the U.S.-led Western powers from 1945 to 1990. Stalin died in 1953 and was then succeeded by Nikita Khrushchev. We live in strange times. One of the reasons that the Democrats decided in the end to nominate Joe Biden, despite his obvious infirmities, was to prevent the accession of somebody named Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders honeymooned in the Soviet Union. He extolled their virtues, much as John Reed and Rex Tugwell did. And, perhaps with the chief guiding light, certainly the most famous of Democrats today, is a Democratic socialist named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her celebrated squad. Now, these people, these so-called socialists, will declare up and down that they are socialists and not communists. And yet, the driving force, the philosophy, the denigration of capitalism is still at the root of their philosophies. They believe that wealth is something to be confiscated and divided up, and confiscated and divided up at their behest, not truly that of the people. And in this, they have echoes of earlier times. And in this, they believe wholeheartedly in the power of the government to make those decisions. But we have seen that when the power of the government, when institutions are eroded, when power is accumulated in the hands of a single person, that awful, terrible things do happen, regardless of whether it was supposed to be good or not. When Lenin and Stalin succeeded the czars, it was seen that perhaps this was going to be a new dawn for Russia, that this was going to lead to better times, because the time under the czars was not some utopia, not some Eden. It was a harsh time for the Russian people. And yet, it became so much worse. It became so much more horrific. It became one of the most brutal regimes ever to grace our history. Today, we rightly and should denigrate far-rightist groups like fascists or Nazism. And yet, we should do the same to the left. And what about those people who try to build institutions? What about those people who preach for separation of powers and the diffusion of power of government away from the state and to the people where it belongs? Instead of tearing down statues, we should be building some of them, particularly to one figure, Milton Friedman, one of the greatest defenders of capitalism that we have ever seen, because we have seen the opposite. The opposite should be avoided. It should be avoided in our hearts and at the ballot box. We shall conclude our Russian and Ukrainian history series with part 5 in a couple of weeks. And what we're going to do is we're going to go from Nikita Khrushchev all the way to a guy who, we'll just say he's certainly in the news now, named Vladimir Putin. And then we're going to finish by trying to explain exactly who and what Putin is. This is Bell Office. As always, thank you for listening.